I'm Bill Quine of Peel Heritage Trust. Manxmen have always had a fine record when asked to serve their monarch. In this recording, made on Wednesday the 4th of March 2009 at Ballygarry House, Glenvine, Colonel Mulcreest told us of his recollections of our own Manx regiment.
Well, now, we're talking about the Manx regiment and how it all started. And my recollection is quite clear. Fortunately, I can remember what happened 50 years ago, but I can't remember what happened yesterday. But in 1938, the situation in Britain was that war was on the way, let's face it. You know, there was a threat from this Nazi regime in Germany. They were determined, Germany was determined to expand, and war was inevitable. So in 1938, the British government had to, or decided to, expand the services in every direction and from whatever source they could find. And the Territorial Army was, of course, well established, had been since the First World War. And surprisingly, I thought at the time, the Isle of Man was asked, could it produce a unit as part of the Territorial Army in the general, you know, expansion that was taking place at the time? So this was agreed, and the Isle of Man agreed. The government here said, okay, we think we can produce the 600 or 700 as was likely to be. And the suggestion and the fact was that we were then allotted a light anti-aircraft regiment, because obviously the threat from Germany was going to be very largely from the air, as it turned out, as we all know. So it was logical that we should produce, which we were able to do, and it started literally in 1938. And we were allotted this number. We were the 15th, in brackets, Isle of Man, Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment, Royal Artillery, Territorial Army. Bit of a mouthful, but that's what it was. Well, in 1938, the middle of 1938, I was 21, 22 years of age, and I was a motor car salesman at the Athol Garage, which was the old family business. And I can quite clearly remember what happened one day. I had a phone call to ask me whether I would like to join this regiment. And I think the reason that I was asked, along with a lot of others, I might add, was because I'd been at King William's College only a few years before, and at King William's they had an OTC, an officer's training corps, which was an infantry boys unit. And when you were in a unit like that, officer training corps, you had to pass certain qualifications, and the thing they issued me with in due course was what was known as Certificate A. And Certificate A was you passed a certain basic tests. Well, this, of course, was a free pass, if you like, into the army. So that was probably why I was asked, together with a lot of other people who had got their Certificate A. And the result was that I was in due course commissioned second lieutenant, and I think we're up in my room here, and I think the original certificate is somewhere in here. That's by the way. I think there were about 12 of us who'd been in this unit at college, and we were therefore part of the unit. Well, then the recruiting started, and I was a bit surprised, really, because we wanted 600. It was split into three batteries, or it became three batteries by the time the war started, And as I've said, you know, that's how it all began. And between the time we were formed in 38 to the actual declaration of war in September 1939, we were training madly, twice a week, every Sunday. And by the time the war started, or actually we were called up a few days before the war was declared, we were more or less set and ready. We didn't do much training off island, but we did it all here. We had some regular instructors joined the regiment, and we had an officer, the adjutant, who was a regular officer. These were the key men, really. All the rest, the commanding officer was an ex-regular colonel from Castletown, Colonel McClellan, and we had three battery commanders, and they were all officers who'd been in the First World War, you see, so they were qualified and suitable. And so we had a nucleus of first, in fact, quite a lot of the men who joined had been in the First World War. I can see them now. We've seen in 1939, the previous war was only 20 years before, so these lads, some of them were in their 40s, you see, so they were all right. They were able to join. So anyway, the regiment was called up. War was declared actually on the 3rd of September 1939, but we actually were mobilized here about a week, or between a week and 10 days before that. So I remember clearly what happened. I was at the garage and the telephone rang, and I was told, go home, get your uniform, get into your uniform, pack your bag, and report to the drill hall now. And the drill hall was the old drill hall, which is still in Peel Road, just below the Brown Bobby. And that was a drill hall that had been put up before the turn of the last century, you see, where I think the volunteers, First World War, they used this. Anyway, this was the place we had to report to. And having got your baggage, you signed up. And then the following morning, we literally went onto the steamship. We had a charter boat, I think, or it might have been the 9 o'clock boat to Liverpool, I can't remember now. And we went down to the ship, and we got on the ship. The night before, we all slept on the ship, tied up to the pier in Douglas. And then at 9 o'clock the following day, we sailed off. We sailed off to Liverpool, and then we were deployed immediately right through the Liverpool dock area. And we had First World War anti-aircraft guns. They were naval 2-pound pom-poms, I think they called them. And we were ready for the war, because nobody knew what was going to happen. I mean, the war was declared. While we were in Liverpool, the 3rd of September, we were having a church parade. Actually, there's a church quite near the landing stage in Liverpool, and we were having a church parade there. And in the middle of the church service, the parson, somebody gave him a message, and he stood up in the pulpit and said, "Gentlemen, I have to tell you that as of now, war has been declared with Germany." Well, you see, we thought immediately, you know, we'd better get out. Probably dropping bombs on Liverpool in 5 minutes. You know, this is the way you think when you're 20 years of age. However, it didn't happen. But war was declared, and we were there. I was actually at regimental headquarters, and we had our headquarters in the basement of the Liver building. You probably remember the Liver building in the room. So right down in the basement, this is where the headquarters, the Max Regiment, was at the beginning of the war. And that's how it all started. Well, quite soon after, within a matter of day or two, all the guns along the dock area I heard them firing, and you know, they were firing their guns, which was probably a good thing, because they knew the guns would work, these First World War guns. And they were letting fly at some planes that were flying in over the Mersey. Well, we naturally thought that, you know, this is it. These are the German planes, but of course it wasn't that at all. What had happened was that the RAF were told quite clearly that if they're going to fly over Liverpool, they must not fly in from the sea or down or up the Mersey. And of course that's precisely what they did. And so our gunners didn't care a damn what they were, these planes, and doing what they're not supposed to do, and therefore we'll have a go at them. So they fired at these planes, and fortunately we didn't hit any of them, but that it proved that the guns worked. So that was really the start of the war for the Manx Regiment. Quite extraordinary. So anyway, we were in Liverpool. Well, then of course, needless to say, because we'd fired at friendly planes, there was a hell of a row about this, and a general came along to hold an inquiry and haul us over the coals for misbehaving. But in point of fact, the boot was on the other foot. We were complimented for doing what we were told we had to do. And if the planes flew in, you know, so that was it. So that was the start. And this went on for a couple of weeks, I suppose. And then the regiment was pulled out of Liverpool, and we were sent then, as a complete regiment, up to an anti-aircraft practice camp, which was a place called Cark, in Cartmel, it's on the shore of up Preston area. It was on the seaside, and this was to get practice firing proper guns at targets, and the targets were towed behind a plane, you see. That was the way they did it. And it was a sort of sleeve, I suppose. But it gave all these lads from the Isle of Man, because let's face it, we were, you know, very green and young and from all walks of life, never seen a gun before. And A, it proved that the guns worked, and you had a basic idea what you were doing. And the weather was appalling. I can remember we were in bell tents, and the rain came pelting down. It was a real baptism. I mean, you know, here we are in the eyes. This is what it's going to be like. This is going to be tough, you know. So we survived all that. And the other interesting thing was that we actually had 20 girls with us. Now, when the Manx Regiment was formed, they formed a detachment of the, it was called the ATS, or Zulu Territorial Service, and this was a female unit, and their job was going to be cooking, clerk work, and so on, and the Manx Regiment had a detachment of these 20 odd Manx girls, and they came with us to Liverpool to cook for us and work in the offices and live in bell tents. Incredible. Anyway, we all survived this. And after we'd been in Lancashire, if you like, for 2 or 3 weeks with the spell in the docks and now at the practice camp, we then moved, the whole regiment then moved down to the south of England, including the girls, and we went to a place called Ashton Canes, which was near Cheltenham, Cirencester, and we were put in a country house, empty country house, and we had a very posh headquarters we set up there, and I was assistant adjutant, and I ran the officer's mess and had to go and buy the food in Cirencester. We lived very well, actually, and that was the start of it. The batteries, the three batteries that we had, were deployed round all the airfields, because the RAF in the south of England had a lot of airfield, Brize Norton, which is still to this day being used, Little Risington, Ashton Keynes, even down into Gloucester, and this is what we were doing. Of course, they hadn't any proper guns. We had Lewis guns, which fired a 303 bullet, and these were scattered all around it. But how they would have done any good or harm, I don't know, but it wasn't bad for morale, I suppose. So fortunately, we weren't attacked, but if we had been attacked, the Germans would have just mince meat on us, I suppose. But still, it was all learning the tricks of the trade, if you like. It was the beginning of our military experience, and as a regiment, it got all the command structure properly organized, who did this and that. I was assistant adjutant, and you know, this was great. The next major thing that happened for me, of course, at that point was that because I was at the regimental headquarters, the adjutant, a fellow called Clive Simpson, who was the regular soldier, and he was the one who'd come to the island for training, he was told that he was going to have to go and do a proper job in the army, instead of, we were now capable of looking after ourselves. So to my astonishment, the colonel came to me and said, now Clive Simpson is going back to join the regular army, I'm going to make you the adjutant. So I blinked and said, well, all right, so if you think so. So anyway, so I was immediately on the spot promoted from second lieutenant to captain, and I was made adjutant of the Manx Regiment. And here was I, you know, 22 years of age, been in the army 5 minutes, and I had a very tough job to do. Of course, on the credit side, I mean, my pay went up by 2 shillings a day, and I got a field allowance of another 2 bob. So I was about 4 or 5 shillings a day more. I was earning in total about £1 a day. I mean, I felt like a millionaire. Yes. And that was the way it was. I mean, soldiers were earning 2 shillings a day. I was now getting £1 a day. And I was adjutant of the Manx Regiment at 22. Crazy. However, needless to say, I mean, it went on for 2 years, but that I didn't know that at the time. So after we'd done this initial business, we were down in the south of England for the whole of the following year. Bearing in mind the war started 3rd of September, take yourself a year forward, because during that year we spent our time really training and defending the country, because for the first few months, nothing much happened. I mean, you know, everybody said we're out of war, but the Germans weren't ready either. And, you know, it was a bit of a farce. But, of course, in due course, they really did start. And of course, they walked over the whole of Europe very quickly. And we had the withdrawal from Dunkirk and so on. And we, at that time, were still along the south of England. And we were worried we could have been invaded, you know. Fortunately, the RAF, well, that's another story altogether, the Battle of Britain stopped it. By the time we got to the end of 1940, we got a signal one day, and it said, the Manx Regiment are going overseas, and the Manx Regiment would have to go to the north of England to prepare for setting off. So imagine this, you've got this whole regiment spread along the south coast of Britain, you've got to gather them together, you've got to go, it's all, I mean, the movement side, you don't organise that, but you know, you had to put them into trains, and we carried the whole regiment up to Glasgow, we took over schools in the Glasgow area, and these chaps were all billeted and trained. And of course, we also had leave. Before we went overseas, we got a signal to say all ranks will have a week's leave, not all together, we had to spread them, and we all came home to the island or wherever, we had a lot of reinforcements joined us because we weren't at full strength, so we had a lot of non-Manx young men. It was rather interesting really, because these reinforcements were all what we called immature or young men. They'd been called up, and they were all around the 20, 21 age bracket. We, of course, had men of 40 and so on. You know, I explained that earlier. So we had about between 50 and 100 of these youngsters. Funnily enough, they were mostly from Lancashire and Yorkshire. They were really nice young men. So there were a few Cockneys amongst them, and we spread them amongst the regiment. And then, of course, having had all this leave, we then were told, right, we're off. That was incredible too, because we were simply told that these ships that we were going to go on were spread around. Some were in Liverpool, but some were in off Glasgow, we were very, very fortunate really, because we were supposed to be going on a troop ship which broke down 2 days before the ship was supposed to sail. So we are faced with having to get onto a ship which breaks down. So what happened was that there was a troop ship came in, but she wasn't a troop ship. She was really, it was the Viceroy of India. It was part of the P&O, British BI, I think it was called. And she came in and from India into Glasgow, they were told, because we've got a breakdown, you are going on this ship, and she's got to be prepared in a matter of days to go straight off again. Well, that suited us very well, because the regimental headquarters and two batteries were allocated this ocean-going liner that was not stripped in any way for troops. So it meant that the only way they could do it was to put troops in the cabins, because she was full of cabins. So where you had a cabin for two people, you would double it up, say four, and you'd put two sleeping on the floor and two sleeping in the beds, you see. And if you've got 600 men, you can imagine what happens. You spread them around all the ship. They're all the troops, the Manx regiment, they were all in cabins. And better still was that they didn't. We had peacetime catering, because this ship had all the chefs that would normally be on a ship going backwards and forwards to India, together with all the Goanese waiters. So they all sat down to meals in the dining room of this ocean-going luxury ship. Unbelievable. Unfortunately, one of the three batteries, 129, they were on a ship which was an ordinary troop ship, so it was a bit unfair really, but there wasn't room for them on our ship. So here we set off in this convoy, and the thing that really shook us was that when we sailed out into the Irish Sea, we looked around, and this convoy of troops, there were 10 ocean-going liners that were converted into troop carriers or like ours, requisitioned quickly, and surrounding these 10 ships were probably equally about 10 Royal Naval escort ships, battleships, destroyers, you name it. Unbelievable. And all this convoy set off, because it was all troops, you see, it was a pretty valuable cargo. Yeah. At least that's what we thought. Anyway, we set off and we sailed right across, as if we were going to America. And when we got a long way across the Atlantic, then they suddenly switched and turned south, and then we went down and went into Freetown, which was for refueling. And then after a few days there, we then set off round South Africa Cape, and we went into Durban, and all these 10 ships all went in there. And we were in Durban for probably a week, I would think, refueling and whatever. We had a marvellous time there, because all the South African people came down to the docks in Durban with cars, you know, and they were waving to the troops on these ships. Could we go ashore? So Henry Kelly and I said, well, yeah, we'd like to do, we'd have a game of golf. So the chap said, oh, we'd love to take you there. So Henry and I went off to some very posh golf course in Durban and had a game of golf, and they ginned us up. It was quite incredible. All the troops had equally good. I could show you photographs. Even the ordinary ranks, they were taken off. On the quayside, these cars queuing up. You know, you can imagine the South African people, this British convoy going through. And of course, it became a habit of them. Anybody who went into South Africa at that time, going to the Middle East, incredible hospitality. So then in due course, after a week, we set off and we went straight up then round Africa. We went into Aden for refueling. And then from Aden, we set off, of course, up the Red Sea to Egypt. Well, now, of course, it was beginning to get businesslike. By the time we got to Suez with all these big ships, they were getting a little bothered, getting into the war zone. We actually, because you couldn't unload all these ships in Suez, and they sent some of them up through the Suez Canal, and we went up and we unloaded in Port Said. Others went on round to Alexandria, so this whole convoy was split between the three main ports. All these big ships offloaded all their troops. And then when we got out, when we got off the ships, we'd had 6 weeks of this. It took us 6 weeks to get from England to. And I could remember when we were going up the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. I was leaning over the rail one day with a fellow officer of mine, a chap called Bobby Littler. And I think we were leaning over the side. We probably had a large gin in our hands from the bar. We're buying gin at tuppence a glass. And I said to Bobby, I said, you know, that was a pretty nice trip. What about going back and we'll do it all again, you know? But of course, it wasn't going to be like that for long, obviously. So anyway, when we got off in Port Said, we then got onto requisitioned Egyptian trains, which took us to Cairo, and then we disembarked in Cairo, and we then went into a transit camp, the whole regiment this time, all three batteries together, and this camp was quite near the pyramids, a place called Beni Youssef. It was actually in the desert, because if you think of the delta, the Cairo is on a delta with the Nile coming down, and of course it's quite well cultivated. But then you come suddenly to the desert, and of course away from the delta, it's just what it is, nothing. And the pyramids, of course, are in the desert, not in the delta. So anyway, we were there for, I suppose, 2 or 3 weeks. But then almost a tragedy. Well, we thought it was a tragedy at the time. But Colonel McClellan was called into the GHQ in Cairo to get his orders of what was going to happen to us. You can't have stayed at a transit camp forever. We were going to be deployed with guns and get on with the war. So he was told by the GOC, probably Wavell, I can't remember who it was, but somebody at that level, his staff, they were short of anti-aircraft gunners in the Middle East. This was 1940, bear in mind. The war had only been running for just over a year. It was the end. We actually were disembarking in December 1940, so you can think about it. And we were told that One of the batteries was going to have to go to Crete, the island of Crete, because the Germans were coming down through Europe and were going to have their eye on Crete. And we were going to get in there to back up, bolster up the Greeks and keep the Germans out. So we sent a battery off to Crete. There was also a war going on down in Eritrea because the Italians, who were also in the war at this stage, obviously, they were subjugating the Eritrean people. They stole the country, if you like, occupied the country. And it was decided by the Allies that Italians were our enemies as well, that we would have to go throw them out. So two Indian divisions sent in, and we were sent down the only light anti-aircraft unit, because the Italians did have a few planes, strange to say. So this one of the batteries, the 41st Battery, went down to Eritrea and were deployed to defend the invading force, because we were the invading force. But that all worked very well because the Italians did have a few, as I've said, a few players. So we did have a little action, and I think we may even have shot one or two down, but we frightened them sufficiently that before very long, the Italians were captured and turned out of Eritrea. So that battery came back. But the other battery, the third battery, were then spread along the whole of the Suez Canal. They were so short of guns, you see. Imagine, it was ridiculous, really. So we were trying to defend the Suez Canal with 12 Bofors guns. And so we had a battery in Crete, and a battery in the canal, and a battery in Eritrea. But we were mad, really, because it was all spread around. The regimental headquarters, of which I was with the colonel and the adjutant, as his adjutant, and we moved down to Ismailia. So we set up our headquarters on the Suez Canal, and we lived in luxury because, you know, it was a lot of the canal pilots, because the canal still had the pilots going up and down, and these were French chaps, so there's some very pretty French girls there, so we had a nice club, so we had, you know, it was pretty cushy job for us, but didn't last forever, obviously, and in due course the battery came back from Eritrea, and Crete, of course, sadly went down the drain because the Germans came in with paratroops and they took over Crete, and they put all the battery of our 129 battery, Manx battery, they were prisoners of war for 2 years. That was tragic. But we were all right, so we had two batteries in Cairo after Eritrea and after Crete. But fortunately for us, we were given another battery to replace the one that was put in the bag in Crete. But in the Middle East at that time, there was a regular light anti-aircraft battery, literally number one, the first light attack battery, and it was regular soldiers, regular officers, but they suddenly came to us. So we now were a full regiment of three batteries again. Well, at this stage, we gradually got them all together. And then, of course, a major part of our story began now, because we were ready for further activity. And it was decided by the powers that be that the Manx Regiment should join the 7th Armored Division and become the Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment for that division. There was a slight stage before that when we were around some of the airfields in the desert, but shortly after that the Germans pushed the Allies back to Cairo and to Alamein, which everybody's heard of. So we joined the 7th Armored Division at Alamein, and we then became the Anti-Aircraft Regiment for this famous division, the Desert Rats, and we stayed with them for the next 4 years. The Manx Regiment, as I've explained where we were, you know, we lost to Battery Creek, we'd been to Eritrea, and we'd been guarding the Suez Canal. Eventually, we got them all together, and we had this battery, the first battery, replaced. At that point, I'd been adjutant for 2 years, and my colonel said, I'm going to promote you to battery commander, to be a major, to take over the 41st Battery. And this all coincided with the move from all these split regiments to join the 7th Armored Division, the Desert Rats. And I was given command of the 41st Battery, and at Alamein, this would be about August. The Battle of Alamein didn't happen till October, so there was a couple of months when, you know, neither side wanted to attack because they had to be re-equipped and so on. And you imagine, you know, bringing, if you think of Egypt and the Allied armies, the British army, you had to bring everything, you know, round South Africa, up the Red Sea. You can't just say we'll start tomorrow. You've got to plan everything. Anyway, on this particular day, I just joined. I'd been with the battery very long. We were doing a probe out from the Alamein line, and I was with the 41st Battery. We were in a position guarding the guns and this whole outfit. And suddenly, I realized that there was an air attack coming in, and I lay on the ground and looked through my binoculars, and I could see these Stuka dive bombers slowing down in the air, and they stopped. And what they did, once they stopped, then they put their noses down and they dive vertically. And as they are diving down, they seemed to sort of scream at you. Now, whether this was something that they deliberately did or whether it was the speed of the plane, but it was quite frightening, if you like. But at the same time, I could see the bombs leaving the plane and whistling down. Well, you don't think anymore until suddenly you realize that the bombs are landing on where you are, virtually. And I don't know exactly how close they were, but they were within yards. And it was a pretty nasty scene. I, unfortunately, was wounded in my arm and leg, and I was more concerned with that, obviously. But then I suddenly realized, you know, there was a lot worse than me. And when it was all sorted out, of course, the fact was that two of the Castletown boys who were on one of these guns, a fellow called Condon and Harding, they were actually killed, and they died immediately. And there was another couple of chaps wounded, and myself. But I survived, and I'm here now. What happened then, of course, I was taken off on a stretcher to a first aid station, which was actually South African, as it happened, and they were really first class and patched me up. Just to illustrate that I was all there, if you like. I looked at the doctor, this South African doctor, who was looking at me, and I said, "I know your face." And I said, "I think your name is Jones," or something like that. And I said, you played rugby for South Africa, and I saw you play at Twickenham. And he smiled and said, "Yes, that's quite right." So I wasn't that bad. But anyway, I was carted off, and from this first aid station, I went down to Alexandria, to a military hospital where, you know, reasonably civilized, and they patched me up again. And then I went by train, I think, to Kantara, where there was another hospital on the Suez Canal. And at this point, I thought, well, you know, I'll be going back to the unit now. But they had a medical board, and they said, sorry, but your arm is not in good shape, and you've been hit in the leg. We're sending you to South Africa. So this shook me up a bit, but anyway, the next thing was I was on a hospital ship going down the Red Sea and eventually ended up in Johannesburg. Going down the Red Sea, just to illustrate the sort of thing, the sort of atmosphere, it was very, very hot weather. And without going into detail, it was a sort of ward full of wounded soldiers. It's not a very wholesome sight, and it was a bit smelly, I think. So the captain decided to turn the ship round and sail it into the wind. And of course, the moment he did that, then you got a gust of fresh air coming through, and of course, it was quite civilized. Anyway, after that, we went on to South Africa and disembarked in Durban, and I went to place called Baragwanath, which was in Johannesburg, which was near Soweto, actually, which was the sort of native area of Johannesburg. And I was there for, I suppose, a couple of months, and well, maybe a little less. And then they just said, right, well, now you're going back to England. So we went down by train to Durban, got onto a troop ship, which incidentally broke down on the way to Cape Town. We got to Cape Town and had to change ships, and eventually I got back to England. One amusing little thing that happened when we were in Johannesburg, there was plenty of everything, and I like a complete ass, thought, well, if there's short of things in the Isle of Man, I can probably smuggle a bit of stuff in. And I remember being ridiculous, like buying a sack of sugar or something. And this came back with my baggage all the way to England. And when I got to Liverpool, and they took me off this troop ship on a stretcher, I had a Red Cross girl carrying me with a sack of sugar, which I was taking home to the Isle of Man. One of those silly things. Anyway, I went home on leave, and then the next thing I found that a posting, by which time, although I'd been in hospital, I had to go to a military hospital in a place called Warrington, and it was actually been a lunatic asylum, I think, before. And I know I was sleeping in a padded cell. This was for officers only, I suppose. Anyway, I had another operation on my arm there, and then eventually I got a clearance and went home, and then I got a posting, and this was a posting to a battery in England, in the London area, and I went as a battery commander, and I was coping with it. I mean, I had got my rank, I'd got a decent job, and I was with a regiment, and I thought, well, you know, this will do me for the war now. But it wasn't the end of the bank trip, as far as I was concerned, because whilst we were stationed somewhere just outside London, my colonel sent for me, and he said, I've got a posting here for you. And he said, it's posting you to a regiment called the 15th Isle of Man, Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment. He said, you don't want to go, do you? So I smiled at him and I said, well, what do you think? I said, you know, let's face it, this is my own regiment. And I said, if they've asked for me, I said, I want to go and I hope you'll release me. Well, he said, if that's the way you feel, he said, you better go. So anyway, I then got this wonderful posting, or pleased me very much, and I went to Norfolk, where the Manx Regiment they'd come back by this time. They'd been through the whole of North Africa, they'd gone over the beach at Salerno, and now they were home, back in England, as part of the Desert Rats, ready for the invasion. So I was then given command of a battery, and that was a wonderful, you know, I was very pleased with that. And then got to June 43, 44 rather, which of course was the invasion of Europe, and I then had the first battery. And the interesting thing about that was that I was given 18 self-propelled Bofors guns. Each battery had six of them, but they put the whole of these, all these self-propelled guns together, and I had this composite battery. Well, an amusing thing happened, because we loaded up all these guns onto a convoy, a troop convoy in Tilbury Dock, and then we set off to sail down the channel to Normandy. And as we went past the Dover Straits, the Germans were sending the odd shell over, because they could, a long distance shell, they could practically get across the channel, and they didn't hit us, unfortunately. But when we got to Normandy, we then had to get ashore. Guns were all transferred from this troop ship onto landing craft. So I had a landing craft with these 18 Bofors self-propelled guns, and we set off for the beach. And as we were going in towards the beach, the Normandy beach, this landing craft hit a sandbank and ground to a halt, and we dropped the ramp gate down at the front. And I went with the young naval officer, who was probably a boy of 18 who was commanding this outfit, and we had a look down, and I said, well, I'm not going in there for a start, because I said, if you make me drive into that, I said, the water is so deep that we're going to be completely under the water. So I said, you'll have to back off and try somewhere else. Well, I said, I can't back off, we're stuck. So I said, well, I can't get off because I'll be drowned. So I said, what are we going to do? So he said, well, we'll have to wait for the tide to go out. So I said, okay, that's the way it is, we'll do that. Fortunately, it was two or three days after the initial landing, and the actual advance landing had gone inland a few miles. So they were not actually actively shelling the beach area. Although we were going ashore on about the third or fourth day after D-Day, it was fairly quiet and not that dangerous. So we just had to sweat it out. And then, of course, we got to a point where the captain and I said, okay, we'll go now. So we fortunately were able to drive off the ramp, and we were not drowned in the process. So that we then set off to join the rest of the division, because by this time I was with the 22nd Armoured Brigade, and we had three tank regiments, and we were part of the artillery that was supporting them, protecting them when they had to stop. So then we got on with the war. The Normandy bridgehead, of course, the Germans were pretty active, and they did pen, let's face it, they did. You know, the invasion army were not, they didn't just walk ashore and go swanning off. I mean, it took some hard fighting. And of course, the country of the Normandy countryside wasn't really suitable for armoured regiments, because if you've ever been to Normandy, it's they call bocage, I think, and narrow lanes, it's rather like the Isle of Man. And, you know, you don't fight tanks going up to Inverurie, and you couldn't do it there. And of course, if you go down and, like, turn around, the Germans are clever enough to spark a gun, you know, just round the corner, and they go wallop, and then if you blow a tank up in the middle of the lane, you stop the whole division going along that lane. It's all right in the desert, you've got plenty of room. So that was part of the problem. So it did take about 6 weeks, really, in Normandy before we broke out. Well, then, of course, we broke out, and then we started off. And, of course, then it really, you did, then got moving. And it didn't seem to take, it took, you know, months rather than years to move right along then through France, Belgium, Holland, and into Germany. And I always remember, you know, the reception that we received, because, you know, all this northern part of Europe, it was all, you know, let's face it, it was the population of people, and I mean, and that they'd been under German suppression, if you like, for a couple of years. They were delighted, you see, with De Gaulle and the Allies arrived, and the war was, we were getting on with it, getting rid of these Germans and back to normality. And then, of course, we moved right through Norway, and we finally got to Hamburg in Germany. And I'll always remember this, because we were, as I say, I was with the 22nd Armored Brigade, and we were having really quite enjoying ourselves. And we'd suddenly got orders that we were going to go into Denmark. Well, this was a bliss to think that, you know, we were going to go into a friendly country away from these bloody Germans. I could remember, literally, we were setting off on the main route out of Hamburg, going up into Denmark, in a convoy. And suddenly a signal started to come through that the war was over. And that was the first we knew. We were in a convoy of guns and troops moving into Denmark, where we were stopped. And the war, they'd signed an armistice, I think, at Lüneburg, Montgomery and the Germans, and the thing stopped then. Well, that, of course, stopped our jaunt into Denmark, which was a bit sad. So we were told on the spot that instead of going there, that wasn't necessary. The Danes could look after themselves. They didn't want us to throw the Germans out. But the Germans would simply pack their bags and go home. So we were then told, the 7th Armored Division, that we were going to occupy Schleswig-Holstein, which was the part of Germany right by Hamburg, between there and the Red Sea, and the, not the Red Sea, the Baltic. I was then given an area to look after, and I set up my battery headquarters at a little village on the Elbe called Gluckstadt. And we went into this little town right on the water's edge. And I said, we'll have those row of houses. So we went in, and I said, right, we'll put our headquarters in this street. Now, whether we threw the people out, I don't know, but we ended up with three or four houses in a row, and that was it. And we were now, you know, the war was finished, what do we do? So the first thing we did in Gluckstadt was life was all suddenly dramatically changed. But I noticed in this little village that there were some rather nice little yachts, smaller, star class they were. So I had an interpreter, and I said to this chap, I said, see if you can do a deal. So he went along and he lent on these owners of these yachts, and we ended up with three yachts, and they were part of the establishment of my battery. So we painted the battery number on these yachts, and we went sailing. I mean, you know, just ridiculous when you think about it. But when you're 20 years of age, the war's over. Come on, boys, you know, let's have a bit of fun. So we did a lot of that, and that was good, and the division settled in, and then I can remember we then started leave. You see, we'd not been home for months, not since the invasion, certainly. So this, I can't remember the exact period, but it was quite a long time. But I can clearly remember coming on leave, and I think I've said this, we'll probably call a halt to this tape, but I had a Jeep, Willy's Jeep, which I'd driven all the way from Normandy to Hamburg, if you like, and this was my private car, if you like, and I then set off by myself in this Jeep to drive to Calais to come home on leave. And when I got to Brussels, you pulled into a military place and filled it up with petrol. You didn't pay for anything, you just said fill it up with petrol. And when I eventually got to Calais, I found a sort of car park, military car park. I said, right, I'm leaving it here. Well, I'm going on leave for a week. So that was all right. And I'd even managed to pick up a 2.2 rifle in Germany, and I even carried that all the way home to Alaman. I mean, you know, imagine going on a ship with a rifle. But the funny thing was, in Calais, I went down to the quayside, and the first thing I saw was one of the steam packing boats, the Victoria. And there was a chap, I just forget the fellow's name now, who was the first officer, Wesby Kissick. He was standing at the gangplank as I walked aboard the Victoria, going on leave. And I said, hello, Wesby. I said, are you in charge of this lot? He said, no. He said, the captain is Ginger Brideson. A very colourful character. You may never have heard of him. So I said, well, where is he? Well, he said, he's not feeling very well today, because he said... he was refereeing a football match yesterday, and he's the worst for wear. Ginger Brideson, who was a character, if you don't, a lot of people will remember it. He was a great footballer and golfer, but he was a character, real Manx character. So anyway, eventually he appeared with a bit of a thick head, and he got to Dover, and I came home.